A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Corin. I have a travel question that is totally on brand for our podcast. I've read that it's possible to hitch a ride on sea cargo. I firstly thought that it was like kind of an internet prank. There was a YouTube video where some guy did it, but I think that was based on a true, it is really a thing. I remember it was quite a convoluted process of getting in touch with one of these big cargo companies. Anyway, according to our show research notes here, it is indeed something. It says our rival AI model says typical characteristics of commercial cargo freight say that they let on 2 to 12 passengers at a time, which is really tiny. And it's slow travel. Atlantic crossing may take 1 to 2 weeks. They also say that there actually isn't any cost incentive, because you might think, why on earth would you want to subject yourself to staying on a cargo vessel if there was any other alternative? And all I could think of was it might be cheaper, but apparently that's not even the case. So the incentives, the reasons to do this are pretty meager, or so it seems to me, but there is definitely a market for this, and I've heard of people doing it. What's the actual deal, Herman and Corin, if you wanted to travel to some, maybe it's across the Atlantic or some other sea route, how would you actually even go about doing this? Like, do you literally just call up a freight company and ask if you can, like, hop on board their next ship? And what is a typical transatlantic travel window? And finally, our colleague says that the one reason that is genuinely, that I can understand is that sometimes these cargo ships will go where it's almost impossible to get through other means. Places like very far south, very far north. Interested to know exactly how this works. How many people actually end up doing it? And is it every freight company operating sea cargo or just a few of them? Herman and Corin, let's talk about unconventional ways to get around the world, hitching a ride on commercial sea cargo in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
There's this persistent internet story that you can just show up at a port, walk up to a container ship, and ask the captain if you can hitch a ride across the Atlantic for a few $100. It's got that whole Jack Kerouac adventure travel, beat the system romance to it. And it's almost entirely wrong.
Almost entirely wrong in every particular, actually. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. We're brothers. We host this show. And the prompt we got today is asking about exactly this. Whether hitching a ride on commercial sea cargo is a real thing, how it works, how many people do it, and why anyone would subject themselves to it given that it's slow, expensive, and involves zero amenities.
The short answer is yes, it is a real thing, but it is the opposite of what the internet mythology suggests. This is not budget travel. This is not a travel hack. It's a highly regulated, bureaucratic, insurance-heavy, surprisingly expensive niche that fewer than 200 people per year actually participate in.
Fewer than 200? For context, about 30 million people take a cruise each year. So we're talking about a phenomenon that is, statistically speaking, a rounding error on a rounding error.
That's exactly what makes it fascinating. Because the gap between what people imagine, this romantic, spontaneous, cheap way to cross oceans, and what it actually is, a rigid, paperwork-intensive, $5,000 voyage where you eat with the ship's officers and have no internet for 10 days. That gap is enormous.
Let's get into it. The prompt asks several specific things. How you actually book passage, what a typical transatlantic crossing looks like, why it costs what it costs, and whether cargo ships serve destinations that are otherwise impossible to reach. We're going to cover all of that.
I want to start with the regulatory reality because it's the thing that most people, including most travel writers, completely miss. The entire structure of cargo ship passenger travel is shaped by one specific international regulation. SOLAS, the Safety of Life at Sea Convention, Chapter 3, Regulation 26. It states that any vessel carrying more than 12 passengers must carry a full-time medical doctor on board. 12 passengers is the hard legal ceiling. Cross that line, and the entire regulatory category of the ship changes. You need a doctor, additional lifeboat capacity, different medical supplies, different safety briefing equipment. The costs escalate dramatically.
12 passengers is the magic number. Above that, you're not a cargo ship with a few guests. You're a passenger vessel, with all the regulatory overhead that implies.
And most cargo ships don't want to be passenger vessels. They're in the freight business. So the ones that do accept passengers cap it at 12, and in practice, most take between 2 and 6. The entire global capacity for cargo ship passengers, across all lines and all routes, is probably under 500 berths at any given moment.
That's astonishingly small. We're talking about an entire mode of international travel that could fit in a single high school gymnasium.
It's shrinking. As of May 2026, only 31 cargo ships worldwide are certified to carry passengers on regular scheduled routes. That's down from 87 in 2015. The trend line is unambiguous.
Before we even get to the experience, the cost, or the destinations, the first thing to understand is that this is a dying niche. It's a vestigial remnant of an older era of maritime travel, and the window for doing it is closing.
Which is exactly why the prompt landed at the right moment. If someone is genuinely curious about this, now is the time to pay attention. In 10 years, it may not exist at all.
Let's talk about the booking process, because this is where the internet mythology completely collapses. The fantasy is that you show up at the port of Rotterdam or Long Beach, find a ship flying a convenient flag, and negotiate passage with a grizzled but kindly captain.
That is not merely impractical, it is legally impossible. Ports are secure facilities governed by the International Ship and Port Facility Security Code. You cannot enter a port without authorization. You cannot approach a vessel without clearance. Attempting to do so is trespassing, and in the post-9/11 security environment, it will get you arrested, not embarked.
The Kerouac fantasy ends in a holding cell.
It ends in a holding cell and a conversation with port security that you will not enjoy. The actual process is the polar opposite. You cannot contact a freight company directly. Maersk, MSC, CMA, CGM, they do not have passenger booking desks. If you call their corporate headquarters and ask to book passage, they will politely tell you they don't offer that service, even if some of their subsidiaries technically do.
How do you actually do it?
You go through a specialized booking agent. There are only a handful in the world. The Cruise People, based in London and Toronto, is one of the largest. Freighter Cruises, based in Germany, is another. There's a small agency in Japan that handles NYK and MOL bookings. These agents have relationships with the specific shipping lines that still accept passengers, and they know which ships have berths available on which routes.
It's not like booking a flight where you can comparison shop. It's more like hiring a specialist broker for something esoteric.
It's exactly like that, and the process takes 3 to 6 months. You need to submit passport information, visa documentation for every country where the ship will dock, a medical clearance form signed by your doctor. Most lines require passengers over 65 to provide additional cardiac and mobility certifications. And you need to carry comprehensive travel insurance that specifically covers evacuation from a cargo vessel, which is not a standard policy provision.
That last part is interesting. Evacuation from a cargo ship is not the same as being airlifted off a cruise liner.
It's completely different. Cruise ships operate on fixed itineraries with established emergency response protocols and are usually within helicopter range of Coast Guard services. Cargo ships may be hundreds of miles from the nearest rescue capability, and the ship itself has no medical infrastructure beyond basic first aid. If you have a cardiac event on a container ship in the North Atlantic, your survival depends on whether the ship can divert to a port with a hospital. And diversion may not be possible if the ship is too large for available ports or if weather prevents it.
That's a cheerful thought.
I'm not trying to be cheerful. I'm trying to be accurate. This is not a cruise. The risks are real, and the insurance requirements reflect that.
You've found a booking agent. You've submitted your paperwork. You've waited months. You've paid for specialized insurance. What does the actual voyage cost?
This is the part that surprises most people. A typical transatlantic passage, say Hamburg to Montreal, which is one of the more common routes, takes about 12 days and costs between $3,500 and $5,000 per person. That works out to roughly $290 to $415 per day.
For comparison, a basic inside cabin on a transatlantic repositioning cruise runs about $80 to $120 per day. And that includes meals, entertainment, pools, activities, and medical facilities.
The cargo ship is 2 to 3 times more expensive per day than a discount cruise, with none of the amenities. And compared to flying, a one-way transatlantic flight can be had for $300 to $500 and takes 7 hours. The cargo ship is 10 times more expensive and takes 40 times longer.
Which brings us to the obvious question, why would anyone do this?
We're going to get to that in detail. But the short version is that the people who do this are not optimizing for cost or speed. They're optimizing for something else entirely, and that something else is what makes the whole phenomenon interesting.
Before we go there, I want to flag one more misconception the prompt touched on. The idea that cargo ships might serve remote destinations you can't reach any other way.
That's actually one of the few practical reasons to do this. Cargo ships call at ports that have no passenger ferry service and limited or no airport, places like Nuuk in Greenland, Nome in Alaska, Ushuaia in Argentina, various Pacific islands. If you need to reach those places and you don't want to fly, or can't fly because there's no commercial service, a cargo ship may be your only surface option.
Even then, it's not straightforward. Cargo ships follow trade routes, not passenger convenience. They call at ports to load and unload freight, and their schedules are driven by commercial contracts, not by any interest in getting you to your destination on time.
Port calls are short, typically 6 to 12 hours, just long enough for cargo operations. You may or may not be allowed ashore, depending on the security protocols at that specific port. Some ports require passengers to remain on board during cargo operations. Others allow you to disembark, but you need to be back before the ship sails, and the ship will not wait for you. If you miss departure, your belongings will be offloaded at the next port of call, eventually, and you'll be on your own to get home.
The freedom of the open sea comes with an almost complete absence of personal autonomy. You go where the ship goes, on the ship's schedule, subject to the ship's rules.
Which, for some people, is exactly the appeal. But we'll get to that.
Let me circle back to something you mentioned earlier. You said only 31 ships worldwide are currently certified for passengers, down from 87 a decade ago. What's driving that decline?
Economics and regulation. For a line like Maersk or MSC, the revenue from carrying a handful of passengers represents less than 0.01% of total revenue. It's not a business, it's a rounding error. And yet the regulatory burden is real. You need to maintain passenger cabins to SOLAS standards, carry additional safety equipment, train crew and passenger safety procedures, manage the booking and vetting process. For most shipping lines, the calculation is simple. It's not worth the hassle.
Why did they ever do it in the first place?
Historical accident, mostly. Many older cargo ships, particularly those built in the 1980s and 90s, were constructed with a small number of passenger cabins. These weren't originally intended for paying travelers. They were for the ship's owner, or for company representatives who might need to travel with valuable cargo, or for maintenance contractors on long voyages. When those cabins weren't in use, some lines realized they could sell them.
It was basically monetizing spare capacity that already existed.
But newer ships, particularly those built after 2020, rarely include passenger cabins at all. The regulatory calculus has shifted, and the marginal revenue doesn't justify the marginal cost. So as older ships are retired, the number of passenger-capable vessels declines, and new builds don't replace them.
Which means the entire phenomenon is essentially running out the clock on a fleet of aging vessels that were never designed for passenger service in the first place.
That's precisely what's happening. And when those ships are scrapped, which will happen over the next 10 to 15 years, the option of cargo ship passenger travel will likely disappear with them unless some boutique operator deliberately preserves it.
The prompt landed at exactly the moment when this is still possible, but clearly in decline. It's like catching the last years of a disappearing railway line.
Let's talk about what the actual experience is like once you're on board, because this is where the romance and the reality have their most interesting collision. A cargo ship passenger is a fare-paying guest on a vessel designed primarily to move freight, not people. The major lines that still do this have dedicated passenger cabins. They're small, they're Spartan, but they exist. You're not sleeping on a pallet in the hold.
Although that would be cheaper.
It would, and also illegal. But the point is, this is a real, structured, regulated thing. It's just vanishingly small. Globally, somewhere between 100 and 200 people per year take these voyages.
We're talking about something that, at any given moment, has fewer participants than a moderately attended wedding.
That wedding probably has better food and more predictable scheduling. But here's the paradox. A transatlantic crossing on a cargo ship takes 7 to 14 days. A cruise ship does the same crossing in 6 to 7. The cargo ship costs $100 to $200 per person per day. A discount cruise runs $80 to $150 per day and includes entertainment, pools, casinos, medical facilities, and edible food served on something other than a mess hall tray. The cargo ship offers none of that. No scheduled activities, no internet for long stretches. You eat with the ship's officers in the mess, which is a privilege, not a restaurant. And your entertainment is the ocean and whatever you brought with you.
It's slower, more expensive, and has no amenities. That's a bold value proposition.
It sounds like a joke. And yet people book these passages, often a year in advance, and many of them are repeat customers. The average cargo ship passenger, according to a 2024 survey by the Freighter Travel Society, is 67 years old, retired, and has taken at least three previous freighter voyages.
Three previous voyages. So they know exactly what they're signing up for, and they keep coming back.
And that's the question the prompt is really asking. If there's no cost incentive, no speed incentive, no comfort incentive, why does this exist at all?
The obvious answer is that they're not choosing it despite those things. They're choosing it because of them.
You don't book a cargo ship passage because you need to get somewhere. You book it because you want the passage itself to be the point.
The journey is the destination, rendered in the most literal possible form.
With the emphasis on slow, quiet, and stripped of every comfort the travel industry has spent a century convincing us we need.
Which is either deeply romantic or deeply unhinged, depending on your disposition.
I'd argue it's a bit of both. And that tension is what makes the whole thing fascinating. But before we get into the psychology of it, we should talk about what the experience actually looks like once you're on board. Because the gap between the idea and the reality is substantial.
I'm already bracing for the part where the romance collides with the mess hall schedule.
It's not just the mess hall, it's the complete absence of autonomy. You go where the ship goes, when the ship goes, for as long as the ship takes, and the ship does not care about your feelings. That gap between the fantasy and the reality gets widest when you try to book passage. You cannot call a freight company. Maersk, MSC, CMA, CGM, none of them have a passenger desk. The actual path is through specialized booking agents. There are only a handful of them globally. The cruise people in London, freighter cruises in Hamburg, a few others. These are small operations, often one or two people, who maintain relationships with the shipping lines that still accept passengers.
You're calling a person who knows a person who knows a captain.
And that person will walk you through a process that takes 3 to 6 months. You'll need a passport with at least 6 months validity beyond your planned arrival date. You'll need visas for every country whose ports the ship calls at, even if you don't plan to disembark. Because in maritime law, entering a port means entering the country, whether you step off the ship or not.
If your Hamburg to Montreal voyage makes a fuel stop in Halifax before continuing, you need a Canadian visa even if you never leave your cabin.
You also need comprehensive medical clearance, not just a doctor's note, but a full physical examination form specific to maritime passengers, certifying that you're fit for sea and that you don't have any conditions that would require emergency care beyond what the ship's medical kit can handle. Which is not much.
This is where Solus comes in, I assume.
This is exactly where Solus comes in. Safety of Life at Sea, Chapter 3, Regulation 26. Any vessel carrying more than 12 passengers must carry a full-time medical doctor. That's the hard legal threshold. Passenger number 13 triggers an entirely different regulatory regime. Different lifeboat requirements, different medical supplies, different crew training, different insurance.
The 12-passenger cab isn't arbitrary. It's a cliff.
It's a cliff. And it's why almost every cargo ship that takes passengers caps at 12. The moment you go to 13, you need a doctor on board, which means another berth, another salary, another set of qualifications. The economics collapse instantly.
Which explains why the whole thing is so small. Each ship takes 2 to 12 people. There are 31 ships doing it, and the math caps the entire global annual throughput at well under 1,000, even if every berth on every sailing were full, which they aren't.
That scarcity drives the pricing. A typical transatlantic passage, Hamburg to Montreal, 12 days, runs $3,500 to $5,000 per person. That's $290 to $415 per day. A basic inside cabin on a transatlantic repositioning cruise runs $80 to $120 per day and includes meals, entertainment, pools, and medical facilities.
The cargo ship costs roughly 3 times as much for roughly 0 times the amenities.
The premium comes entirely from scarcity. There are only about 30 ships worldwide that accept passengers. Each takes 2 to 12 people, and the demand, tiny as it is in absolute terms, still exceeds supply on popular routes. Some sailings book out a year in advance.
We've established that it's expensive, slow, difficult to arrange, and devoid of comfort. What's the actual experience once you're on board? You mentioned eating with the officers.
The social hierarchy on a cargo ship is strict and immovable. Passengers eat in the officer's mess, not the crew mess. This is a privilege, not a social choice. The crew mess is off-limits to passengers, and the officer's mess is where you're expected to take your meals at designated times. You don't order. You eat what's served, when it's served. The food is functional. It's designed to sustain a working crew, not to impress paying guests.
You're essentially a guest at someone else's workplace, and the workplace has a rigid structure that predates your arrival by decades.
You have no standing to change it. You have the run of the ship in the sense that you can walk the deck, use the passenger lounge if there is one, spend time on the bridge if the captain permits it. Bridge access is a common perk, actually, and many passengers cite it as a highlight. But you must follow all safety protocols. You attend the safety briefing. You know where your muster station is. You wear appropriate footwear on deck. You do not enter operational areas during cargo operations. The ship's work comes first, always, and your presence is conditional on not interfering with that work.
What about port calls? You mentioned earlier, they're short and unpredictable.
6 to 12 hours, typically. Long enough to unload and load containers. Whether you can go ashore depends on the port. Some ports require passengers to remain on board for security reasons. Others allow disembarkation, but you need to be back before sailing, and the ship will not wait. If you miss departure, your passport and belongings will be offloaded at the next port, and you'll be responsible for getting yourself home from wherever that is.
The romantic notion of exploring exotic port cities is mostly fictional. You might get 3 hours in Antwerp on a Tuesday afternoon.
That's your exotic adventure. The prompt mentioned a YouTube video, someone who supposedly did this and made it look like an adventure hack. A real counterexample, a passenger on the CMA CGM Vasco da Gama in 2024 documented a 14-day crossing from Le Havre to Montreal. 4 other passengers on board. Meals with the chief engineer. No internet for 10 of the 14 days. The passenger described it as, quote, the most peaceful 2 weeks of my life, unquote, and also noted that by day 9, the lack of stimulation had become physically disorienting.
That's a fascinating tension. Peaceful and disorienting at the same time.
Which is exactly what we'll get into when we talk about who does this and why. But the point for now is that the experience is not an adventure in any conventional sense. It's closer to a meditation retreat on an industrial vessel, governed by maritime law and the chief engineer's meal schedule.
The MV Lubov Orlova incident comes to mind here. Not because it's directly parallel, but because it illustrates what happens when the regulatory framework around passenger vessels breaks down. A cruise ship decommissioned, sold for scrap, broke its tow line, and drifted unmanned through the North Atlantic for months. The regulatory complexity of getting passengers on and off vessels is so intense that when the system fails, you get a literal ghost ship.
That's the extreme case. But the everyday reality of cargo ship passenger travel is shaped by the same regulatory framework, just functioning as intended. The difficulty isn't a bug, it's the system working exactly as it's designed to.
Which means that anyone who wants to do this needs to understand that they're not buying a ticket. They're applying for permission to exist in a regulated industrial environment for 2 weeks. And the environment has no obligation to make them comfortable. That's the how and the what. But the question hanging over all of this is, who actually signs up for this? because the numbers we're talking about are vanishingly small. 100 to 200 people per year, globally. That's not a market. That's a support group.
The Freighter Travel Society did a survey in 2024. The average cargo ship passenger is 67 years old, retired, and has taken at least 3 previous freighter voyages.
It's a repeat customer base. People who do this once tend to do it again and again.
Which tells you something right there. It's not a bucket list item for most of them, it's a lifestyle. And the survey identified 3 main motivations. The first is remote destinations. Cargo ships go places passenger services simply don't.
This was the part of the prompt that actually made sense to me. If you need to get to Nome, Alaska, or Newark, Greenland, or Ushuaia at the tip of Argentina, your options are limited.
There is no passenger ferry to Newark. The monthly cargo service from Rotterdam, 8 days, $4,200, 6 berths, booked 8 months in advance, is one of the only ways to get there by sea. A flight from Copenhagen to Newark costs $800 and takes 4 hours. The cargo ship costs 5 times more and takes 8 days. Nobody's choosing it for efficiency.
They're choosing it because the 8 days is the experience they're paying for, not the destination.
And that's the second motivation the survey found, what passengers call sea therapy. The complete absence of stimulation. No internet, no news, no entertainment, no decisions to make. You wake up, you eat, you walk the deck, you watch the ocean, you sleep. For 10 or 14 days.
The passenger on the Vasco da Gama called it disorienting by day 9, but also the most peaceful 2 weeks of their life.
Several passengers in the survey described it as a kind of forced reset. You can't check your email because there is no email. You can't doom scroll because there's no signal. The ship's indifference to your existence becomes the feature. The world is not asking anything of you, and you have no means to offer anything back.
It's a meditation retreat where the meditation is mandatory, and the retreat is an industrial vessel moving through a Force 9 gale.
For some people, that's precisely the appeal. Which brings us to the third group, ship enthusiasts. A small but passionate community of freighter nerds who want to experience working vessels. These are people who can tell you the difference between a Panamax and a post-Panamax container ship who follow shipping routes the way other people follow sports teams.
Of course there are.
There absolutely are. And they're the ones who book the most obscure routes. The monthly service from Yokohama to Vancouver via the Aleutian Islands, 18 days, $8,200, 4 berths, that's the most expensive cargo passenger route in 2026. And it sells out.
Because, for the freighter nerd, the Aleutian Islands in October on a container ship isn't a hardship. It's the Super Bowl.
That enthusiasm is genuine. These passengers want to be on the bridge at 0600 watching the navigation. They want to eat with the chief engineer and ask about fuel consumption rates. They're not tolerating the working vessel. They're there for the working vessel.
The motivations are remote access, forced disconnection, and pure enthusiasm for maritime logistics, none of which are about saving money or hacking the travel system.
Which brings us to the geography question. The prompt asked whether every freight company does this or just a few. The answer is just a few, and the routes they serve are shaped entirely by trade patterns, not passenger demand.
Where can you actually go?
The most common routes are transatlantic, Europe to the east coast of Canada and the U.S., and Trans-Pacific from the west coast to Asia, usually via Hawaii. There's also a steady Australia to Southeast Asia corridor. Arctic routes exist, but they're seasonal, June through September only, and they require ice-class vessels, which narrows the options further.
The South Atlantic? Africa to South America?
Most cargo on that corridor moves on container ships that don't take passengers. There's no regular passenger-certified service. You'd have to piece together something custom, and the booking agents will tell you not to bother.
The map of where you can go on a cargo ship isn't a map of the world. It's a map of specific trade corridors where the shipping lines that still take passengers happen to operate.
Which connects directly to the economics. The prompt asked why shipping lines bother with passengers at all, and the answer is, they barely do. Passenger revenue is less than 1/100 of 1% of revenue for lines like Maersk or MSC. It's a rounding error.
It's not a profit center. It's a legacy feature they haven't turned off yet.
Here's why it exists in the first place. Some older ships were built with passenger cabins for what are called owner's representatives, company personnel who would travel with the cargo to oversee sensitive shipments. When those cabins weren't in use, Lyons discovered they could sell them. The revenue was marginal, but the cabins were already there.
The entire global cargo passenger industry is an accident of ship design from a previous era.
That era is ending. Newer ships, those built after 2020, rarely include passenger cabins. The regulatory burden of maintaining SOLA certification for 12 passengers outweighs the marginal revenue. So as older ships are retired, the passenger berths disappear with them.
Which is why we've gone from 87 certified ships in 2015 to 31 today.
The trend is accelerating. As of early 2026, only three major lines still accept passengers on regular schedules. CMA, CGM, through their La Meridionale subsidiary. Hamburg Süd, now part of Maersk, and they're only honoring existing bookings, they're not taking new ones. And a handful of Japanese lines, NYK and MOL, on specific routes.
Grimaldi stopped in 2023. MSC stopped in 2019.
The window is closing. And there's a further factor that's going to accelerate this, autonomous cargo ships. The Yara Birkeland launched in 2022 as the first fully autonomous container vessel. NYK has autonomous ships planned for 2027. These vessels have no crew quarters at all.
No crew quarters means no passenger cabins, no officers' mess, no chief engineer to eat with. The entire infrastructure that makes cargo passenger travel possible disappears.
That's the emotional core of this whole thing, I think. The cargo ship passenger is a remnant of a pre-jet age mode of travel, slow, expensive, uncomfortable, and completely indifferent to your comfort. It survived into the 21st century as an accident of ship design and maritime regulation, and within a decade it'll probably be gone. Before we get too misty-eyed about the end of an era, let's talk about how someone actually does this while the window is still open. Because the prompt asks for the practical path, and the practical path exists, it's just narrow.
Start 6 months ahead. That's rule one. If you wake up in June and decide you want to cross the Atlantic on a container ship in July, the answer is no. The booking agents will tell you no. The shipping line will tell you no. And the port authority will definitely tell you no.
6 months is not a suggestion. It's the minimum. Between the medical clearance, which requires a doctor to sign off that you're fit for 2 weeks with no medical care, beyond a first aid kit, the visa checks for every port you'll pass through, the evacuation insurance, and the security vetting, the paperwork alone takes 3 months, and the berths are already being booked.
The medical clearance is worth underlining. These ships do not have doctors. If you have a heart condition, if you need regular medication that requires refrigeration, if you're over a certain age with certain risk factors, the line can and will reject you. They're not being cruel. They're being realistic about what happens in the middle of the North Atlantic.
You don't call the shipping line directly. That's the second rule. Maersk will not take your call about a passenger berth. Neither will MSC or NYK. You must go through a specialist booking agent. There are only a handful globally. The cruise people in London, freighter cruises out of Hamburg, Maersk freighter cruises in the US. These are small operations, sometimes one or two people, who maintain relationships with the lines that still take passengers.
You're calling a person who knows a person. It's not an online booking form.
It's a phone call followed by a lot of email. And the agent will walk you through what's actually available, because what's advertised and what's actually sailing on your preferred dates rarely match. Cargo schedules shift for commercial reasons. A ship scheduled for Hamburg to Montreal in October might get rerouted to Rotterdam to Halifax. The agent is the only person who knows the current reality.
That brings us to the cost. The prompt asked whether this was cheaper than alternatives, and we've established it's not. But let's put specific numbers on what you should actually expect to pay.
For a transatlantic crossing, budget $3,000 to $6,000 per person. The lower end is a basic cabin on a shorter route, maybe 10 days. The upper end is a nicer cabin with a window on a 14-day crossing. That's roughly $290 to $430 per day. For comparison, a repositioning cruise on a mainstream line runs $80 to $120 per day. You are paying a premium for the absence of everything.
You have no recourse if things change. The ship reroutes for weather. You go where the ship goes. The port call gets shortened from 12 hours to 4. You get 4 hours. The departure gets delayed by 3 days because of a strike in Hamburg. You wait 3 days. Your ticket is not a contract for a specific experience. It's permission to be on board while the ship does its actual job.
Which is why the booking agents will tell you to build flexibility into your schedule. Do not book a non-refundable flight home for the day after your scheduled arrival. The ship might be 2 days late. It might arrive at a different port. The agent will advise you to book a refundable ticket, or just wait until you're actually in port to arrange onward travel.
For someone who's intrigued but not ready to commit to 6 months of paperwork and $5,000 for 2 weeks of staring at the ocean, where do you start?
The best entry point is CMA CGM's Mediterranean to Caribbean run, Marseille to Fort de France, 10 days, around $3,800. It's a relatively short crossing, the weather is usually reasonable, and the route is well established. For something longer, Hamburg-Sud's Europe to South America routes, Hamburg to Santos, 14 days, around $4,500. Those are the beginner routes.
The Arctic routes, Rotterdam to Newark, anything through the Aleutians, save those for your third or fourth trip. They're more expensive, more likely to be cancelled due to ice conditions, and the isolation is more extreme. If you discover on day 4 that you hate the experience, you want to be on a route where the next port is 5 days away, not 12.
The Freighter Travel Society, freightertravel.org, maintains a current list of accepting lines and recent passenger reviews. It's the single best resource for understanding what's actually available right now, as opposed to what was available in 2019. The landscape changes every year as lines drop out.
There's the Cruise and Freighter Travel Association. They publish a quarterly route update. Between those two sources, you can get an accurate picture of which ships are sailing, which berths are open, and what the experience was like for the last person who took that route.
If you're curious but not ready to book, the Freighter Travel blogs are worth your time. There's a small community of repeat passengers who document every trip in obsessive detail. What they ate, what the cabin looked like, how many containers were on board, what the chief officer said about the weather routing. It's a niche within a niche, and the blogs are strangely compelling.
The freighter nerd literary genre.
It exists, and it's wonderful. One passenger on a CMA CGM run from Le Havre to Montreal wrote 3,000 words about the ship's meal schedule. 3,000 words. And it was interesting.
Because the meal schedule is the structure of your day. Breakfast at 0700, lunch at noon, dinner at 1800. You eat with the officers. You do not eat with the crew. That's a maritime hierarchy thing, and it's non-negotiable. The mess is the social hub of your existence.
The blogs capture that. The small rituals. The way time stretches. The strange intimacy of eating every meal with the same 4 people for 2 weeks while the ocean does nothing in particular outside the window. It's not adventure writing. It's something closer to monastic literature.
The path from curiosity to actually doing this is, start 6 months ahead, contact a specialist agent, budget $4,000 to $5,000, get your medical clearance and evacuation insurance, pick a beginner route, and accept that you are not in control of anything.
If that sounds appealing rather than terrifying, you might be one of the 100 to 200 people this year who actually do it.
We've established the path exists, but it's narrowing fast. The question that sticks with me is whether this whole thing disappears entirely or just mutates into something else.
That's the open question. As the last lines phase out passenger cabins, does cargo ship travel simply end? Or does it get preserved by boutique operators converting retired cargo ships into dedicated passenger vessels? There's precedent for that. The expedition cruise industry was born when research vessels got retired and repurposed.
A converted cargo ship isn't really the same thing. The whole appeal, if you talk to the people who actually do this, is that the ship is doing its real job. You're a guest on a working vessel. The indifference to your presence is the point.
The moment you convert a cargo ship into a passenger vessel, you've created a cruise ship with industrial aesthetics. The containers are props.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.